ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 11, text 43, translation and commentary. By His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Pita si lokasya chara charasya. Tvamasya pujascha gurur gariyan. Natvat samostya pihadi kakutonyo. Lokatraye pya pratima prabhava. Prabhava. Sorry. Pitasi lokasya chara charasya. Tvamasya pujyascha gurur gariyan. Natvat samostya bhyadika kutonyo. Lokatraya pya pratima prabhava. First translation, you, this is Arjuna speaking to Krishna, you are the father of this complete cosmic manifestation, of the moving and the non-moving. You are its worshipable chief, the supreme spiritual master. No one is equal to you, nor can anyone be one with you. How then could there be anyone greater than you within the three worlds, O Lord of immeasurable power? Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna is worshipable as a father is worshipable for his son. He is the spiritual master because he originally gave the Vedic instructions to Brahma, and presently he is also instructing Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. Therefore, he is the original spiritual master, and any bona fide spiritual master at the present moment must be a descendant in the line of disciplic succession stemming from Krishna. Without being a representative of Krishna, one cannot become a teacher or spiritual master of transcendental subject matter. The Lord is being paid obeisances in all respects. He is of immeasurable greatness. No one can be greater than the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, because no one is equal to or higher than Krishna within any manifestation, spiritual or material. Everyone is below him. No one can excel him. This is stated in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Natasya karyam karanam cha vidyate natatsamascha bhyadikascha drishyate. The Supreme Lord Krishna has senses and a body like the ordinary man, but for him there is no difference between his senses, his body, his mind, and himself. Foolish persons who do not perfectly know him say that Krishna is different from his soul, mind, heart, and everything else. Krishna is absolute, therefore his activities and potencies are supreme. It is also stated that although he does not have senses like ours, he can perform all sensory activities. Therefore his senses are neither imperfect nor limited. No one can be greater than him. No one can be equal to him, and everyone is lower than him. The knowledge, strength, and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are all transcendental, as stated in Bhagavad Gita, Janma Karma Chame Divyam Evang Yo Veti Tatvataha. Tyaktva Dehang Punarajanma Naiti Mam Eti Sorjuna. Whoever knows Krishna's transcendental body's activities and perfection after quitting his body returns to him and doesn't come back again to this miserable world. Therefore, one should know that Krishna's activities are different from others. The best policy is to follow the principles of Krishna. That will make one perfect. It is also stated that there is no one who is master of Krishna. Everyone is his servant. The Chaitanya Charitamrita confirms, Ekala Ishara Krishna Arshava Bhritta. Only Krishna is God and everyone else is his servant. Everyone is complying with his order. There is no one who can deny his order. Everyone is acting according to his direction, being under his superintendence. As stated in the Brahma Sanhita, he is the cause of all causes. Pitasi lokasya characharasya tvamasya pujyascha gurur guriyan natvatsamostyabhyadika kutonyo lokatraye pyapratima prabhava. You are the father of this complete cosmic manifestation of the moving and the non-moving. You are the worshipable chief, the supreme spiritual master. No one is equal to you, nor can anyone be one with you. How then could there be anyone greater than you within the three worlds, O Lord of immeasurable power? I chose to speak on this verse, in which Lord Krishna is described in several ways, establishing him as the Supreme Lord, but particularly I was focusing on the words Gurur Gariyan, the most glorious spiritual master, because today is Guru Purnima, also called Vyasa Purnima. It's the appearance day of Vyasadeva, and it's a day for worshipping the Guru. Actually, I meant to speak this morning. It might have been more suitable to have a meditation for the whole day, but there was some misunderstanding about this. So this is... It's an important day in Vedic culture, Hindu culture, because the whole Vedic culture, it stems from Vyasadeva. His name is Vedvyas. Vyas means he who divides. So what did he divide? He divided the Vedas. In other words, he organized the Vedas. Originally Veda is one, he divided into four. and he compiled all the Vedic knowledge in a systematic way. So all gurus are supposed to be a representative of Vyas. The guru sits on the Vyasasan. That means that he's sitting on the seat of Vyas, which means that at least when he sits on the seat of Vyas, everything he says is supposed to be authoritative. He's supposed to be speaking the same message as Vyas. That is called in Latin, in relation to the Pope, ex cathedra. That means it's words which he speaks which are in his role as the Pope. Something else he may speak just out of his personal opinion. But when the guru is sitting on the... Actually, all the time, that's why he's guru, but especially this is the official position. So it's important to understand, because this guru worship is very central to Vedic culture. One cannot receive Vedic knowledge without going through a guru in the proper disciplic succession. And it all stems from Vyas, which is why all these scholars, these so-called scholars, they want to study the Vedas and make comments on Vedic culture, but they're not. They're outside. They don't know what's going on. They're not part of the tradition. They have no right or authority. It's like a quack in medicine. They can just try and do something by themselves, but it doesn't work properly. So, although all the gurus, actual gurus, they're supposed to be following Vyas. Nowadays, You have so-called gurus who are actually, they talk really, some of them may talk in such a way that is actually offensive to the Vedic culture and offensive to Krishna. They may say things like, oh, why bother about Krishna? He wrote a book so many years ago. There's some so-called guru who's being promoted on the internet and people think he's a great intellectual, although he doesn't speak anything of any actual intellectual worth. And people think that if you insult Krishna, that makes you a great thinker. Why is that? I guess people are foolish and they're attracted to wrong ideas. But actually, the real guru is one who speaks according to the teachings of Vyas. The teachings of Vyas are traditionally accepted in six schools, which all claim adherence to the Vedas. Not that they all are based on the Vedas. Of all the schools, of Vedic philosophy, or the Shaddarshan, the six, sometimes called six philosophies, or six ways of seeing. Of all of them, the Mimamsaka school sticks closely to the Vedas, and the Purva Mimamsa and Uttara Mimamsa. The Purva Mimamsa, they stick to the words of the Veda Sanghitas, which, anyway, I won't get into so much detail here about that. But the point is that they all should follow Vyas and respect Vyas. But Vyas is Bhagavad avatar. He's an avatar of the Supreme Lord. And they all ultimately point to Krishna. Vasudeva Sutangdevan Kaṃsa chānara mārdhanam devaki paramānandam krishnaṃ vande jagat gurum. This well-known verse of Shankaracharya, composed by Shankaracharya, in which he praises or names Krishna. Krishna is the god, deva, who is appeared as the son of Vasudeva. He is the crusher, or the destroyer, of Kaṃsa, Chānara, and so many other demons. He is the giver of supreme bliss to Devaki and Krishnam Vande Jagat Gurum. Krishna is, we worship, we offer our respect to him as Jagat Guru, the guru of all the worlds. So this is very much central to Vedic culture. We in ISKCON, we don't celebrate Guru Purnima or Vyasa Purnima. We celebrate the... Well, there's one letter from Srila Prabhupada who said that this is actually celebrated, this Vyasa Purnima is actually celebrated by the Mayavadis. And we worship the Guru on his appearance day. Actually, outside the Gauriya Mata and ISKCON, the Vaishnavas also, they observe Vyasa Purnima or Guru Purnima. But my understanding of why Srila Prabhupada said this is because the general understanding in Hinduism today is that, well, all the gurus, they're all different gurus, but they all teach the same thing. And it's all the same anyway, which is not a fact. So it's been appropriated by the Mayavadis. The actual guru is Krishna, and then there's the individual guru. And the individual guru should point to Krishna. Actual guru means the Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru. Krishna is the guru of everyone. Then you may say, why do I need any guru? Well, Krishna made that system. He is Samashti Guru. He is the guru of everyone. And there's Vyashti Guru, the guru who appears as the manifestation of Krishna. There are many, many who are one's individual guru. But the original guru, or the guru of everyone, is Krishna. But that doesn't mean that anyone who calls himself a guru is a guru. Who is actually a guru? Shadkarma Reparao Vipra Mantra Tantra Visharadaha Avaishnava Guru Nasyad Vaishnava Svapacha Guruhu. One may be very expert in all the Vedic understandings and rituals and all these things, very knowledgeable. But if he's not a Vaishnava, he's not qualified to be a guru. But if one is from a background of dog eaters, someone who cooks dogs and eats them, pretty low down on the social scale, but he's a Vaishnava, then he's a guru. Of course, if someone becomes a Vaishnava, he stops eating dogs, but the point is that one may be from a very low background. But if he's a Vaishnava, he's a guru. If he's not a Vaishnava, he's not a guru. Because if one teaches the right thing, then he's a guru. If he teaches the wrong thing, he's not a guru. Even if one is very expert in word jugglery and Vedic performances. Now, regarding this topic of guru bhakti, which is especially manifested on this day, but actually everyone, every day, the first thing one is supposed to offer respects to one's guru. So I thought of speaking on this topic just after Ram Navami this year, Rama Navami, Ram Navami. On that day, I recited some prayers called Nama Ramayana, and so also did one of my disciples, and he published under the name Nityananda Das. He's favored by Saraswati, and as much as Saraswati is the goddess of learning and music, so he is a good brain for scholarship and good musical talents and singing talents, and he's using that in the service of Krishna. So he sung this and he sent me the link to his recital, which in technical terms definitely was far superior to my rendition. So then Nam Ramayana is I'll speak a little bit more about that. Then I saw, I looked that up a bit, and I saw on YouTube there were several recorded recitations of this hymn to Lord Rama. And I saw one of them by two young girls, presume it must have been from South India. Everything about them was South Indian. And I just saw before they started their recitation, they put on the screen written in English, our salutations to the Carnatic music legend, and they're referring to M.S. Subbulakshmi, which you probably haven't heard of, but if you're devotionally inclined and you live in South India, then definitely you were. To the Carnatic music legend, M.S. Subbulakshmi Amma. So I was very pleased to see that, because it's Guru Bhakti. They probably never met her. She died some years ago. I don't know if they met her or not. Now, she's very famous for her devotional recitations, and it's still, it used to be more widespread, but you used to hear, I used to travel widely in South India. I still do to some extent. But we used to hear from the houses early in the morning, a recording of her singing the Venkatesh Subrabhatam, the morning prayers, greetings to the just waking up Venkatesh, the deity. If I was in South India, there would be no need to say all these things, but I have to give a little background. That the Balaji is known as at Tirumala, Tirupati. So her recitation of that is very famous, as is her recitation of Vishnu Sahasranama. It used to be that in every Brahmin house daily they would recite Vishnu Sahasranama. Then they put on her, instead they put on her recording, and now nothing. But her recording used to be very famous. And her recitation of Bhaja Govindam, the prayers by Shankara and his followers, her recording of that. But she made many devotional recordings. And they're well known and very popular in the devotional world. Now, whether or not it should be made a public matter, and of course there are many women singers, and it may not be so very tasteful, but hers is with many women, men, whatever, often they're singing, even if it's supposed to be devotional. There are various we could say almost sexual overtones, or not very pure. She was the daughter of a Devadasi, which was what used to be in India since time immemorial. Some young girls were dedicated in their youth to the deity in a temple, and then they were trained how to sing and dance for the pleasure of the deity. And they would sing and dance only for his pleasure, not in public. The British, they stopped this because they thought that it's just an excuse for prostitution, because often the Devadasis, although they weren't supposed to, they were used for prostitution by certain people, as if there was no prostitution in all the cities in Britain and all over the British Empire. But they thought in their high morality they had to stop this. Although it was a long-standing tradition of devotion. We find in Chaitanya Charitamrita is described how Sri Ramananda Rai was training young girls how to sing and dance for Jagannath, the Devadasis. So these young girls who are singing Nama Ramayana, they first, as is proper, they wanted to offer their respects to Guru. First, before we undertake any activity in God's service, we have to offer respect to the Guru. We can't go directly to him, only by his mercy, or in this case her mercy. It's not that she was a Diksha Guru, but she was, and like I say, she may not have even been known by, she may not have even met them or said anything, there's so much implied in that statement. The implication is that, well, God gifted her, this M.S. Subbulakshmi, to sing very well, and she'd been trained, probably trained by her mother, who had been trained in a whole tradition of how to sing. And she had mastered the techniques of doing so. She had a voice that was... actually, if you hear her, it doesn't even, you wouldn't even know. It's just her voice is low scale for a female. So it's hardly knowing that it's male or female, but it's she sings in a very sober way, a very devotional way, Carnatic music style. In India, there are two traditions of classical music, the North Indian Hindustani or Drupad style, and South India Karnataka style. And North Indian music especially has become, well, the Northern style, there's a lot of mixture with the folk style of the various bhakti schools, and harmonium is used, which cannot be used in South Indian music, although they have for some technical details. And actually harmonium, for the technical point, it destroys the... By having a limited scale or limited notes, whereas It destroys much of what is possible in Vedic music. There are no keyboard instruments. So in South Indian music, they have also incorporated some Western instruments. Violin is very popular. Anyway, the point is the South Indian style is up to the present day very sober. Whereas North Indian music style, it's something like the whole psyche and mentality of North Indian people and South Indian people in devotion. The North Indian people tend to be very effusive and emotional, whereas in South India it's very staid and respectful. So her style is very much like that. She's sung commercially also, but it's her devotional songs that remain the most popular, and for which she is remembered and honored, not for her commercial songs, because commercial songs, they're always new ones, right? They're always new songs coming, but the devotional songs, that remains, just like Vishnu Sahasranama, that's been going on for at least 5,000 years when Bhishma Dev spoke that. So it's not that we have to make a new version. It was good then, it's good now, and it'll be good in the future. It's perfect. Whereas with commercial music, that always has to change because it just appeals at a very shallow level. So, and this Nama Ramayana, it's simply the names of Rama, names connected to his pastimes, that's all. It doesn't directly express bhakti with words like, we worship you, or we bow down to you, or we surrender to you. But nevertheless, it's completely steeped in bhakti because that's the only way to approach Rama. When we sing his names, that means we're appreciating his qualities. We don't even know who wrote this song because he didn't give the name, the poet. He's passed away. Whoever that poet is, he's passed away. It's an ancient song. It's not a new song. But his feelings, his bhav, his bhakti remains, and that is there. It's passed down generation by generation to generation. His feelings for Lord Rama, which others, they can take that song and take those feelings and reproduce those feelings. Those feelings come out of the heart, that naturally when one hears or sings the names of Lord Rama, then one becomes attached to him, or one's feelings for him, they become expressed. So she, in singing that song, she captured that, as anyone who sings with feeling, but she's graced by Saraswati to sing in such a way that it excites the emotions. It speaks to the heart, and therefore these girls, I should have recorded their name, but I didn't. But anyway, they wrote this, that our salutations to her. There's no need to do that if there's no bhakti. That's the point I'm making. By putting this, they were expressing their feelings of devotion to her. Now, you wouldn't. There may be so many famous singers, right? In my lifetime, the famous singers are singers like John Lennon and Bob Dylan and Mick Jagger, and you may have heard the names, fortunately or unfortunately. And many people sing their songs, no doubt. You can find some cheapo band in Zagreb probably singing songs of the Beatles. Probably. People imitate them. But no one, when they sing their song, no one starts it saying, with great respects and all honor to Mick Jagger. They don't. There's no such idea that you should offer respect to him, and there's nothing to respect anyway. It's the songs that he sings, they touch the mind, but not the heart. Or even if there are songs that touch the heart, there are many singers who sing songs, I left my heart in, where is it, San Francisco or something? I left something like that. So there are songs which, but it's only at the mundane emotional level. Once I saw at an airport, there was a song being sung, a very nostalgic song, famous song. I saw someone was singing this song. It's a very nostalgic song, but it doesn't mean anything, but it sounds nostalgic. So, a wider shade of pale. And I saw the man was singing and he was looking like this and with look on his face, and I thought, is this a joke or what's going on? He's obviously just imitating, he doesn't have any real feelings. But then I realized, no, actually he's just making a drama of feeling some deep feelings. But obviously he doesn't have any deep feelings. He's doing it, you know, he has to pay the bills. Some people do it by sweeping the road, some people do it by ripping others off, and some do it by entertainment. So it's entertainment. It doesn't reach anywhere near the soul. But the devotional songs, they reach to the soul. And that's not only in Indian tradition, we may say in the Christian tradition also, the hymns. Much of the great music was for the pleasure and glorification of, more for the glorification of God. The idea of giving him pleasure in bhakti is not very much developed in the Christian tradition. There's no such idea of offering him food, offering clothes, any such thing, but to glorify him. So anyway, they were offering their respect to her with and so much just from that one line, our salutations to the Carnatic music legend Srimati M.S. Subbu Lakshmi Amma. And the word Amma also means mother, so there's that idea that she's just like a, seeing her as a mother, she's older to us, we feel she has good feeling to us, just like a mother to the children. So in that little statement, they're offering their profound respect. And also, it's implied, it's not said directly, that we are gifted to God to sing. We can sing nicely. No doubt their parents, their two sisters, they had sent them for training in how to sing. In this style, not in the, you can get training in how to sing and dance in so many different styles. The most popular in India is the filmy style. People want the filmy style, Bollywood style, or Collywood, or Tollywood, or whatever. So, but their idea that we recognize that we are gifted by God to sing, and we shall do so for his pleasure and the pleasure of his devotees. We know that there are so many before us who have also sung for his pleasure, and no doubt they are better than us in singing and this and that, but we have to sing also, isn't it? Because it's not that we're trying to outdo anyone or show that we're great, but by singing in this way, we simply want to engage our God-given propensities in his service. We're singing in the style, practically it's an imitation, doing in the same way as Amma has done, this M.S. Subbu Lakshmi has done. We're indebted to her for singing and for she didn't have to sing these songs, she was making her money from commercial singing. We're not trying to outdo her, but by singing like this, we're worshipping Lord Rama, and we're worshipping or offering our respects, profound respect to her simultaneously. So it's an offering to her as well as to Rama directly. So just that little thing gave me hope that even though India today is so, it's astonishing how degraded the culture is and going down so badly, but still there's some hope, as long as this spirit remains, that basic humility that we have to offer respect to the elders, and especially in the proper line, offering respect to those who are offering respect to Lord Rama. So that I was thinking about this, and it reminded, there's so many, one of the dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of books I've thought of writing, but life is limited. But it'd be very nice to make a compilation of stories of Guru Bhakti from the Shastra and from tradition. I was just thinking of Mahabharata, how Yudhishthira, the battle is about to start. No one has fired any arrows yet. All of a sudden, Yudhishthira fires one arrow and then another up in the air. One lands at the feet of Bhishma, just in front of him, in front of his chariot. And one lands just in front of Drona. And no one can understand what's going on. Why is Yudhishthira doing this? If he wants to shoot his arrows, surely he can shoot them directly at Bhishma and not miss him, not fall short. And why is he doing that when the conches haven't blown to actually start the battle? But Bhishma and Drona understood, and they fired their arrows just over his head. So they understood. By firing that arrow, he's at his feet, they're offering respects because they're the gurus. And by firing one back over his head, they're giving a blessing, because Yudhishthira is just like the disciple. And Bhishma said that, good, it's good you did that. Because I gave you, by doing that, you're offering your submission to me. You're offering your submission to me that now I have to fight with you. And try to fight means I have to try to kill you. All that I know about fighting, all that I know about everything, I learned from Bhishma and Drona. So, but if I'm going to fight, before I fight, I have to, whatever I learned, I have to offer respects to my gurus. And you're my guru, so I offer respect. How do you offer respect to a fighting guru? That's how, but someone who taught you archery, you do like that. You fire the arrows, it just falls right in front of their feet. The expertise you can do from a distance. So so he's indirectly saying, you now have to bless me so that I can fight. Before fighting, you take blessing. Before you do anything, you take blessing from your guru. So they send back their arrows of blessing. Yes, you are blessed. And Bhishma said, if you hadn't do that, I would have cursed you that you cannot succeed. Now you've done that, then I curse you that you'll win. So Bhishma has to fight against them, but he's already blessed them that they will win. So it's an unusual situation. And they also had to fight with full force to try to defeat him. Otherwise, if they didn't, they would be lax in their duty to their own gurus. So it's a very unusual situation. That's why Arjuna, he became perplexed. How can I fight with my gurus? You can't fight with your gurus. But it was such a situation where they had to fight with their gurus. And Yudhishthira didn't become bewildered in this matter, nor did Bhishma. But Arjuna did, by the arrangement of Krishna. So this spirit of Guru Bhakti, that is central to Indian culture, and even the Mayavadis, and you can't be a real bona fide Mayavadi and I'm not speaking facetiously here, and you can't be in an orthodox school unless you are the disciple of someone else in a bona fide disciplic succession. There are four lines coming from, paramparas coming from Shankara, in the north, south, east, west of the country, Badrinath, Dwaraka, Puri, and Rameshwaram. And then one other is, not Rameshwaram, Sringeri. And then that's the four dhams. The three of the dhams are mixed with that. And then one more is supposed to be in Kanchipuram. And then there are others in North India, they say Varanasi and this and that. But the point is, one should be in a proper disciplic line if one is to represent the teachings of Vyas. But that's also the Buddhism, the gurus and different schools and paramparas in Buddhism and Jainism, Sikhs, practically their whole religion is worship of the guru and worship of the book. The only thing is they forgot God. They emphasize so much the book and the God, the book and the guru, that they've even in their book, their books, their the book, not books, the Guru Granth Sahib is full of praises of Krishna, but somehow or other they forgot Krishna. Even the tantrics, even many Muslims, they have the system of peers, it's called peers in Bengal, they call them like that. They're just like gurus. And even if someone's driving a truck and then he brings a young boy, and the boy is called the cleaner, and the boy cleans the truck, and he learns how to drive from the driver, and becomes just like his, the idea, he's just like my guru, he's teaching him how to go in a how to drive a truck. So that's central to the Vedic culture, and we find it right from, it's not something that came in at some point, but it's right there all the way through. We find in Ramayana that Lakshman, he served Lord Rama, not thinking that he's God, I have to serve him, but he's my elder brother, and just like a guru. And just when they were in their exile, then just their beginning, Lakshman prayed to Nidra Devi, the goddess of sleep. Now you leave me for 14 years. You don't come, because every night Lakshman would stay awake, guarding Sita and Ram. Lakshman, he became later Ramanuja, Ramanuja Acharya, also known as Lakshman Deshika. And another name of Ramanuja is Lakshman, and known as Lakshman Deshika. Deshika means one who gives desha, upadesha, one who gives instruction. So previously as Lakshman, he directly served Lord Rama as a perfect servant. And later as Ramanuja, he taught how others also can, must, and should serve Rama. And within the Ramanuja Sampradaya, especially, well, that's actually one central message of Ramayana. It's full of, the whole thing is Guru Bhakti, how Rama is devoted to his father, guru figure, then to Vishvamitra. And throughout we find that. And Ramanuja, in Ramanuja Sampradaya, very, very prominent. There's one narration, there are so many in the Ramanuja Sampradaya. Just one, I'll say that at one point some people, they wanted to kill Ramanuja by, actually not one, several times within his life people wanted to kill him. So one time there was some food which was poisoned, which was supposed to be given to him, but the wife of the man who she was ordered to mix poison with the food, then she warned him, and then Ramanuja became
it became a big thing that there was some attempt to poison him. Then Ramanuja's guru, I believe that was, he had several gurus actually for different functions, for initiation, for teaching him, for giving the name. So that must have been Goshti Purna, I believe it was, came up to see what's going on. He came to see Ramanuja. So Ramanuja got the news, and he came. If you heard your guru is coming, you have to go out to meet him. So Ramanuja went to meet him. Ramanuja followed by his own disciples, and naturally, when he saw his guru, then Ramanuja fell flat to offer obeisance, and fell flat in the hot sand. In the summer, which is the sand becomes extremely hot. To walk barefoot on that is very difficult. You get blisters all over your feet. That story is there of Sanatana Goswami. So Ramanuja fell down, face down in the hot sand. Now the system is actually that the disciple, if he offers obeisance, especially if it's after a long time without seeing the guru, then he'll remain offering obeisance till the guru tells him to get up. So the guru was standing there, and then he said, he didn't tell him to get up. So Ramanuja was lying in the hot sand. Then one of Ramanuja's disciples, seeing this, he started chastising Ramanuja's guru, that why aren't you telling him to get up? He's lying in the hot sand. It's quite an amazing thing how he dared to chastise his guru's guru. And then the Goshti Purna, I believe, was told Ramanuja, okay, now you get up. Now this devotee who chastised me, he shall cook for you. You see the point? That was it Kuresh? That he would go to hell for chastising his guru's guru, but he was prepared to do so. Because his guru was put into that difficulty. So he should cook for you. No one else. This man can be trusted fully. That was the point. So there are so many stories of devotion and devotion to guru. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he was sent by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who he was trained by from birth in devotion and understanding. And Bhaktivinoda sent him to Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj to take initiation. And Gaurakishore Das Babaji Maharaj, he was unschooled, whereas Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was a great scholar. Gaurakishore cared nothing for this world or its morality. Not that Gaurakishore was mixing with women or any such thing. He was very much against that. But he didn't care for this world. Sometimes he would go naked. He appeared to be something like a madman. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur took initiation from him, and he stated that I came to realize that all the teachings of the Vedas, all the understandings passed down in parampara, all the great, I studied so much, but then I came to realize that all the teachings, everything that is to be understood in all the shastras is contained in one particle of dust at his lotus feet. And by that understanding, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur became empowered to preach Krishna consciousness so powerfully himself. At one point, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, I shall not live at Radhakund. And Rupa Goswami says that the essence of all advice is to live at Radhakund and fully absorbed in chanting, serving, contemplation of one's original spiritual form, one should pass one's days at Radhakund. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, I shall not live at Radhakund, I shall live at Govardhan, which is just a little distance from Radhakund. He said, I am not fit to live there at Radhakund, but I shall live close by, and I shall go there to serve my gurus. Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Gorky showed this, Babaji. They are there. They are fit to live there. But I will stay at a little distance and I will go there and serve and come back. I am not fit to live there. So this is the attitude of the devotee. Of course, this is at the very high and topmost platform, but that's how reality works, how Krishna has set up the universe, that tadvijnanartham sagurum eva abhigacchet. One has to go to the guru to get that knowledge of how to serve Krishna and can become free from this material world. So when one is free from this material world, like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, then what do? Not like the Mayavadis, who the Guru Mara Vidya, I learned everything from the Guru, I don't need the Guru anymore, kill the Guru, I'll become the Guru. But when you've learned everything and you've achieved, of course you can't learn everything, that's only for Krishna who knows everything. But when one is spiritually perfect, what does he do? He serves his gurus. Why does he serve his gurus? Because they're serving their gurus. And ultimately it goes up to Krishna himself. So this is God's arrangement, that one accepts a guru so he can come out of this tamasima jyotir gamaya, come out of this darkness of this material world, this ignorance of this material world, and go to the land of light, the spiritual world. But one can only go high by remaining low. This by thinking, Trinapeka Otihin. We just sung this song about Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that he's praying for the mercy of his gurus so that he can become just considering himself very low. So one can go high by thinking oneself low. But if one thinks that I'm high, then he's not high. If he thinks I'm very low, then he's high. So it's a paradox, not able to be understood by materialistic people. But the point is that Krishna is very great. Guru Gariyan, we just read here in Gita. He's the guru of all gurus. He's Tvamasya Pitasya. Tamasya Lokasya Characharasya. He is the Pitas, he is the father of all the worlds, of all moving and non-moving beings. So this is not known in the Western world. There have been gurus who have come to the West and people have followed them, some famous gurus, the Guru Maharaj Ji and the Yogi Mahesh and later this Rajneesh, Osho, and they whipped up personality cults. Actually, in the case of Yogi Mahesh, not so much a personality cult. It was more like a business. You pay for the mantra and like this. In the case of this Guru Maharaj Ji, forgotten now, largely forgotten. Even Osho, largely forgotten. But, personality cult. And there's so many, they come and go. Nowadays, it means by advertisement, this what's his name, Sadguru or something. They've promoted him as some great guru. And then some years ago, it was very popular, this, what's his name, that Sri Sri something. And they promoted him and... But they don't really have anything to offer. But people feel they want to follow, but they don't know what is actually the system of Guru Bhakti. And there may be so many cheaters also. That's the culture is there in India, but it's exploited by cheaters. That's also there. But it is shocking often to people in the Western countries when they see the level of devotion. That devotees had for Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada didn't tell the devotees that when I come to the airport, you perform ecstatic kirtan and you jump up and down and you cry and fall on the ground. He never told them to do that. They did it spontaneously. Once one woman in America said to Srila Prabhupada, "These people, they worship you." She said it in great shock. Prabhupada said, "Yeah. I'm all, just like I worship my guru. It's just the most ordinary thing. That, I worship my guru. They worship me." But in the West, it's a very unusual thing. Once I arrived in the airport in Vienna, and a couple of devotees came up and they said, should we offer obeisance? I said, well, why not? So they did. And they said, well, someone else told us we shouldn't because people won't understand. I told them they won't understand anything about us, why we're dressed like this, what philosophy we're teaching. You offer obeisance and they can get used to it. If you don't do it, then you'll always be conditioned by what they think. You do what you have to do. That's your culture. You've adopted this culture now. In the West, they have hero worship. I was talking about Mick Jagger. You can go to a rock concert with some big rock, what do they call, rock stars. And people will be, screaming. But there's no love. There's no idea of any exchange of good. Not that the rock star does any good for you. He entertains you, that's all. When it's over, it's over. It's finished. But the relationship between guru and disciple, that is on the eternal platform. It's giving people ultimate benefit, not just you go to a concert and after a couple of hours it's all over and it's finished. And it's just some temporary titillation for the senses. That's why these Ridvigvadis, they lost the track of what's going on actually. It's a monstrous concoction that there should be no more gurus. Of course, as we always have to qualify that by saying, yes, there have been and there are, and there will be no doubt problems with the gurus in ISKCON. But that doesn't mean you just cancel out the whole institution and make some imagination that after Prabhupada there are no more gurus. I was mentioning that to one of my disciples here just yesterday, that what had happened, there was one of my disciples, she'd stopped chanting around, so I got on her case. I got quite heavy with her, and then this other devotee told me, and now she's chanting again. Why should I take the trouble to get on her case? And why should she take me seriously if the guru-disciple relationship isn't there? Otherwise you have a Ridvik, and what the hell do they care about anyone? They do some sacrifice and they say, now you're initiated by Prabhupada, and then they're on their own actually. There's no one to see to them, no one to care for them. And even if they want to say to someone, why are you chanting around? Who are you to say to me? I'm Prabhupada's disciple. Who are you to say? So it's an anti-devotional. So Srila Prabhupada, in the beginning of the purport of this verse, he says that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, is worshipable as a father is worshipable for his son. Now this example he's giving for his English edition of Bhagavad Gita, and that's also from the Western perspective, that's completely, what's this? The father is worshipable by the son? And no one worships anyone. What to speak of the son worshiping the father? The son worship the father? It's just unimaginable. They're a long way from that culture. But that's very much there, in India today that idea is still there, that the guru becomes just like the father. That kind of relationship is expected. A spiritual father who means the father gives direction, and it's not just giving some lessons like in a school, but it's with concern and wanting to see the child or the disciple come up and flourish. Of course, that can be controversial or misused. Or I just one example I can give that at one of our major centers, not so long ago, one of our major centers in India, there was some international investigative team from within ISKCON about charges of corruption and misbehavior, and corruption and other forms of misbehavior. And one of the members of the investigative team told me last year that he had spoken to the devotee who is the guru of most of the devotees in that project, and said that, look, we've uncovered all this, and we need your cooperation to root this out of this major center, Prabhupada's movement. And the guru said, well, you see, they're just like my children, and I can't just get on their case like that. So one has to be careful not to be overly sentimental in the relationship also. Because, of course, the father is expected not only to be affectionate like a father, but, well, part of the father's affection is to chastise and put the disciple on the proper path. So guru bhakti and being a guru without proper teaching and proper following by disciples, it becomes farcical or not to the proper standard. Srila Prabhupada, he stressed very much on how the disciple has to follow. And he himself said, because I'm following my guru. Rather, I've been talking this evening about, you could say, about the sentiment of guru bhakti or the sweetness of guru bhakti. But really the first thing is to follow and take the discipline. And then the sentiment and the sweetness follows. If we emphasize the sweetness of bhakti or the joy of bhakti without the surrender, then we're left with just a shell. Because bhakti, the very basis is surrender. If we want the joy of bhakti without the surrender of bhakti, then it just becomes shallow, not the real thing at all. And that's true in guru-disciple relationship also. But at the same time, although Srila Prabhupada writes here in his Bhagavad Gita purports that devotional service should be executed as if in military discipline. Well, in a good military leader, actually his followers, the soldiers, they also love him and he loves them. But it's a tough love, you could say, because he has to train them how to go and fight enemies and kill and be killed. So it's a very tough situation. But it makes a strong emotional bond. For the devotee, he thinks that I'm very low, I'm very sinful, God is so great, I'm so far from Him, I'm so unqualified to reach Him. But He's very kind and He's come to me in the form of a guru. So even He might not seem to be perfect in some ways, or may even mistreat me in some ways. But for what He gives me, I'm eternally indebted. So the guru, he has to give, knowledge of Krishna, guidance on the path of to go to Krishna. And then even if there are some apparent misbehavior, one shouldn't see that. One should be very careful not to emphasize the bodily activities of the guru. Or even it may be the guru, you see, he's a householder, he has his children, he's playing with his children, and you think, what's that? What's going on? He's just playing with his children like an ordinary person. But that kind of thing one shouldn't see. One should see, he's giving me the proper instruction. It's a strong emotional bond. Then we think, apichet sudara charo bhajate imam ananya bhag sadhu reva samantavya samyag vyavasito hi saha. Even if someone appears to be acting very wrongly, if his intention is actually to serve me, Krishna says, fully, then he should be respected as a sadhu. Such a person should be respected as a sadhu. Now, some people may protest, this is a double standard. How can you say that? If someone does something wrong, he does something wrong. You can't say it's right just because he's a devotee. That's a very dangerous philosophy, that we cannot do anything wrong because we are God's people. Antinomianism, I think it's called this. Once Srila Prabhupada in Australia, what was going on? Devotees, they need lots of flowers, right? Flowers are required for offering to Krishna. Krishna likes flowers very much. Here, just all around, there's so many roses are growing. You have plenty of roses to offer to Krishna every day. Well, at that time, the movement was in Australia was very poor. They didn't have any garden for growing flowers, so they used to go and steal them. Especially for Rath Yatra, you need lots of flowers. And when they got caught, it was a big court case, and it was much publicized. If anyone had stolen flowers, it wouldn't be a big thing. But because it was Krishna's devotees, and they're talking about love of God, it became a big thing. So there was one lawyer defending them. And when Srila Prabhupada came to Melbourne, then these lawyers, it was more than one, they were speaking with Prabhupada, and they were implying that, yeah, we defended them, but actually they did some, these boys and girls, your disciples, they did something wrong. And Srila Prabhupada became very grave, and he spoke to them about the purpose of life and how one has to dedicate his life to Krishna. And indirectly, Srila Prabhupada was telling the lawyers that your whole life is wrong. Everything you're doing is wrong. You're just wasting your life. And Prabhupada many times said that, actually. But he would speak to people and point out, but not directly say, you're nonsense. He would sometimes, but many times he'd just speak to them in a way so they could understand their nonsense. But many times I was just listening to a conversation which Srila Prabhupada said that I was just saying to this man again and again and again that Gandhi has misrepresented the Bhagavad Gita, but he couldn't get the point. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj said to Prabhupada, no, he couldn't get the point, because then if he would have to admit that his whole life, this man Prabhupada was speaking to, his whole life had been wasted because he was a follower of Gandhi. So, devotees are always glorious. Of course, this can be misused, and it has been misused even within ISKCON, of course, anywhere. It can be misused. The role of a guru can be badly misused to cheat others. But still, it's Krishna's system, and if you can get a real guru, then we're very fortunate. I feel very fortunate. I should feel much fortunate. It should be unlimited. I'm so fortunate that I have Srila Prabhupada. Krishna came to me in the form of Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada said at one time, even a damn fool like me can become a guru. Such humility. But he said the system is jare deko tare koho Krishna upadesh. Many times he said that. That if we just simply speak the message of Krishna, and then you become a guru. That's the basic thing to be a guru. that you speak the message of Krishna. Don't cheat others. Give them the message of Krishna. And in that spirit, on that order, I've taken the role of guru, because in the mundane way, the sons become fathers. So the disciples, they're supposed to become gurus. You offer respect to Ganga by taking the water of the Ganga and offering back to the Ganga. You offer respect to the rishis by reciting the Vedas. You offer respect to Guru by passing the knowledge that you receive from him. You have to pass that on to others. Just like if the son doesn't become a father, then the family line is stopped. So if a disciple doesn't become a guru, then the parampara is stopped. So notwithstanding the disqualifications, that is the qualification. One may not be qualified in all respects, in so many ways, but if one simply wants to pass on what he has heard, then can be and should be a guru. If by doing that I can convey the same teachings without changing, then that is my service and the service of all followers of Srila Prabhupada. And then in the next generation also, there have to be so many gurus. Taking just to take the same message and pass it on. So all the now in India the day of Guru Purnima is over. Here also the day is finished. Now it's Rahu's time. Rahu is swallowing the moon just now. That's just about to start. So the worship of the gurus has been done this day, and we ourselves feel ourselves most fortunate to be sitting at the feet of such a guru, unprecedented. Nabhuto nabhavishyati. What Srila Prabhupada has done is never done previously, never will be done. But still, it's the same message. Srila Prabhupada, established his authenticity, that he's giving the same message. So just give the same message. Hare Krishna. Any question? It's a bit late. Akalanka Chandra. What is that? Akalanka Chandra Dilo Darshan. Shakalanka Chandra Arki Prayojan. The spotless moon of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu arose. He manifests himself in the world. And then Rahu thought that, then what is the need of this moon with spots? When the spotless moon of Gaura Chandra, Akalanka, Gaura Chandra, Dila Darshan, Shakalanka Chandra. So then Rahu, thinking there's no need of any moon with spots, now that the spotless moon of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has arisen, then he swallowed the moon. Hare Krishna, Vancha Kalpataru Pyaschaki Pas, Indivivacha Potitanam Pavadi Pyo, Vaishnavi Pyo, Namo Namaha.